All right, everyone. Hello and welcome to the first section of Computer Science E52. My name is Matthew Chartier and I'll be hosting this section for this semester. We're going to start off by talking about SSHing and our nice.fast.harvard.edu server, which we'll be asking you to connect to frequently throughout the semester. So I think the first thing we should probably address is what exactly is SSH and what is nice.fast.harvard.edu? Because we should probably have somewhat of a basic understanding of that before we ask you to start doing it and doing things without questioning them. Better for you to learn exactly what it is you're involved in so that you can apply it in the future. So when you're SSHing to a server, what you're essentially doing is connecting your computer to a remote server which contains whatever files you might need to access to. So most of the people in here are probably familiar with the idea of connecting to a server simply through connecting to a website through a web browser. So if we were to pull open a web browser and just type in something like google.com, for example, our web browser reaches out across the internet, goes to whatever server is located at the address google.com, and returns us this website, which is rendered and lets us do whatever it is we wanted to do with Google. If we, however, type in nice.fast.harvard.edu, we don't really get anything there. So it seems like whatever stored at nice.fast.harvard.edu is meant for a different purpose. It's not something that our web browser can understand, not something it's meant to deal with. What nice.fast.harvard.edu is meant to deal with is something called SSHing. So SSH stands for Secure Shell. And what that means is you're able to establish a secure connection between your computer and another one, which allows you to interact with that server in such a way that you're giving an interactive shell prompt. And what that looks like is this. So you see we have this nice command line interface. We can access whatever files are available on our shell account. You see I have all these folders laid out here that I can get access to. And so, yeah, this is just the method by which we're connecting to the server, and you don't need to know a whole lot more than that. So what we're going to address next is exactly how you can use SSH to connect to the server that we're using throughout the course. So for those of you who are using macOS, what you'll do is macOS 10, which most of you will be using, actually comes with software built in, which allows you to SSH to a server. It's called Terminal. It's not something that most Mac users will be using the majority of the time. It's kind of a technical thing, which is mostly there just because macOS is built on a Unix architecture, and it's very useful for power users who might want to get down to the bare bones of things, but not necessary for your normal user. So right on the course website, we actually have a short explanation of how to SSH. Essentially, all you have to do is go to Macintosh HD or wherever it is that you might, whatever it is you might have your hard drive labeled on your Mac. It's probably very easy to find. Under that, you go to Applications, then Utilities. You open a program called Terminal. And what you type in is just where we have a line on the screen here where it says SSH-X. nice.fast.harvard.edu, which is just a way of telling the terminal that we want to establish an SSH connection with the server located at nice.fast.harvard.edu. And it's really as simple as that, and once you type that in, much like I've done a similar type of connection, you'll get a screen like this that you can log into to enter your password and have access to all your files and begin your work for the course. Now, if you're working on Windows platform, you want to go to the course website if you have not done so already. Go to the software link on the left side of the screen, and you can download something called PuTTY. It's a really simple, easy-to-use program. You don't have to even install it. You just download it and run it. What it'll do is bring up this screen here. There seem to be a lot of options, but most of you don't have to really worry about. Right here near the top of the window where it says host name, you just type in nice.fast.harvard.edu, which is the server we'll be using for at least the first part of the year. Later on, we'll be dealing with the CS50 cloud. It's just as easy to connect to that. Nothing you need to worry about at the moment. And then it's really as simple as clicking open. A window will pop up. You type in your account name. In my case, that would be Chartier. It prompts for a password, which I would then provide. And I'm logged into my account just like that. I'm going to switch back to my previous login state just because I have some settings which are a little more optimal for our purposes right now. So does anyone have any questions? Is that pretty clear? Basically how to SSH and get connected to the server to start? Okay, so now what we have here is our shell interactive shell command prompt. And we can type some simple Unix commands, some that you should be aware of, just like ls shows all the files or directories that are in the directory that you're working with, lets you know where you are, what you can access from where you are. If you want to get to a different folder, say I want to go to my CS50 folder, you just type in CD and then the name of the directory you want to get to, in this case CS50. Change directory CS50 and just shorthand, that's easier to type. I hit LS again, and I find that I've got these other folders which I've placed there previously. How did they get there? Mkdir, make directory, then just type in the name of the folder. And you see I've got a new folder which I can go into and create new files. So that's great. We've got some directories we can work in, but that doesn't really help us in terms of actually making something that we're going to be using. So what we're going to talk about next is how we can create text files and edit them. So the way we do that in this Unix system that we have access to an interactive shell for is by using a program called Nano. Now, you're all probably familiar with text editors. Like on Windows, there's Notepad. On Mac OS, there are similar equivalent programs. Very basic, low-level text editors. We're not talking about things like Microsoft Word or OpenOffice, anything like that. Those are very complicated programs that allow for all types of formatting. Much more involved than these simple programs we're going to be using. The simpler, the better in this case, because we just want to be able to get at the raw text in the file and change it so as to write down our code and get it compiled later on, which we'll talk about afterwards. So let me just navigate into our section folder here. Now I've prepared just a text file. Before we start getting involved in C source code, let's just take a look at Nano itself and see what we can do with that, just because I think a little familiarity with the program will help you a lot more to be efficient when writing and editing your code in the future. So let's just open up this file I've prepared, just some text. It's a text file, so it ends with the TXT extension. It's not actually absolutely necessary to put file extensions on your files in a Unix system. It's not dependent on that, but you definitely should anyway, just because it's good convention and it'll help you out if you do. So let's just open that with Nano. Notice I type in Nano and then the name of the file. Even if that file didn't exist, I should type in the name of whatever file I want to make. For example, just to demonstrate this, blank.txt. It opens up a file called blank.txt for me to edit, and this is how you create a new file in Nano. I don't need this right now, so I'll just leave out of that. I want to go back to the one I've already prepared, just some text.txt, and here we have a little welcome message just for the section. Oh, hi, this is CSI E52, so welcome again. So anyway, what I'm trying to get across with this, other than the welcome message, is just to demonstrate some of the difficulties you might have working with a shell prompt in terms of text editors. Now, when you're using something like Notepad, you have the benefit of a graphical user interface. You can take your mouse, you can point wherever you want, you can click on things. If I want to edit this text, I'll click here. If I want to edit this text, I'll click here. It's pretty simple. It's pretty intuitive. It's great. It's why most operating systems we use now have graphical user interfaces that work that way. But when we're using the shell prompt, we don't really have that luxury. If I click right here, and then I'm clicking, you know, and then I start typing. No. The point at which I'm interacting with what's happening on the screen is showed by this small green square. And the only way that I can move that around on the screen is by typing on my keyboard. I'm hitting the arrow keys, I'm moving around. So when dealing with a long file like this one, and a file is much longer than this, which you'll see in some of your source code, it becomes a little bit tedious hitting up, down, left, right, just to get to one small spot in the code that I want to interact with and change. So just a few tips to help you out with this and make it a little easier and less awkward to work with Nano at first. There's some keys on your keyboard that you've probably never really used for anything or thought about their purpose. So let's talk about the home and end keys first. Say I want to get from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen without sitting here for 3 seconds and waiting for my green cursor to move. If I want to get to the left side, I hit home. If I want to get to the right side, I hit end. Simple as that, one keystroke and you're there. If I want to get much lower on the screen without holding down my down arrow key or get back to the top, I can press page up or page down and it'll drop to the top or bottom of what I can see at the moment, and then when I press it again, it'll go even farther. This is going to be absolutely invaluable when you're working with code later on. Oftentimes in the course, we see people early on trying to show us what's on maybe line 232, and they sit here for a while telling us what's going to be there, and we wait around. But you have the benefit now, so you'll be able to work with this a little better. Also, just another very small thing that a lot of people don't realize, which is actually kind of surprising because it's a very useful thing to know. Just when you hit backspace, obviously, it goes back, it erases what's behind that. When you hit the delete key, it erases what's ahead of it. That's not a big thing. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but when you're working with your code and you have to get rid of indentation and correct that, it's just one more little tool that makes things go a little smoother and might help you out in the future. So I just thought I'd like to mention it. Okay. So we've talked about Nano. We've taken a look at how we can use text editing. Oh, one more thing. I should cover this before we start getting involved in C and getting sidetracked. You'll notice at the bottom here, we have these angled kind of caret symbols followed by letters. These all correspond to commands. Normally in a text editor, you might go to the top of the screen, you'd have file, you'd have edit, you'd have view. We don't seem to have that here in the shell prompt, and that's, again, because we're dealing exclusively with keyboard input. So if we want to save our file, we use write out. So control O, it asks me what I want to save it as. I want to save it as the same file. Done. We've made whatever changes we wanted to make, in this case none, and we've saved that file. A couple of other commands which are very useful. Say you have a line of code that you just don't like or which you want to place somewhere else. You could very tediously, very slowly erase everything in that line and then retype it somewhere else because, again, we don't have the benefit of click, drag, copy, paste like we would in a Windows or Mac environment. So instead of doing that, you see where it says cut text. We can hold Control K, cut a whole line out, move it somewhere else, and then uncut text, Control U, and it's back where we want, we want to place it now. Suppose I want to put it back. I go up to the line I'd like it to be placed above, hit Control U, or below rather, hit Control U, and now it's there. This is if you hold Control and then press K several times, it copies multiple lines. Control U, it pastes those back out. You don't have to worry about memorizing that. Just I wanted to show everyone so they can kind of get a sense of the way it looks. These commands are always at the bottom of the screen for you to reference, and the names are fairly intuitive as long as you've seen them being used once. So just keep mind of them and try them out in the future. It'll save you a few headaches and a lot of time. And the last command, obviously, Control X, just to exit. It'll ask you if you want to save your modified buffer. All this really is a fancy way of saying, do you want to save your changes as you would get in a pop-up window in any other system? Just hit Y. It's going to prompt you for the file name to write out. That's fine. Just keep it as the same name unless you want to save it in a different file. Hit Enter, and you're out of there. So, does anyone have any questions right now about how to use Nano or how to do something specific in the program that I might have forgotten to address? Okay, good. So let's get to the meat of what we're really dealing with here. Let's talk about C. Okay, so what exactly is C? Obviously, it's a programming language. I expect everyone here and everyone watching is probably familiar with that concept. But what exactly is a programming language? What defines, what constitutes a programming language? And how are they used to provide instructions to the machine and then create these files, which we use every day, these programs to provide instructions to the computer so it executes in a certain way and gives us the results we want. So a programming language is basically just a set of words, syntax, and grammar that we can use to, which is relatively easily, read and written by humans, which allows us to kind of provide instructions to the computer in a way that we understand. So let's open a file right now and start dealing with some source code just to better understand how we would write C. So what I have here is kind of a sample framework for a program that I prepared ahead of time. Up here, just a little bit of formatting. You see where we have these slashes followed by asterisks. If you ever include /*, then type something, it doesn't matter if it extends a few lines, and then follow it by the reverse, asterisk, then slash. Everything in there is commented. And what that essentially means is that when this goes from being source code to a working program, everything that's in there is completely written off. Nothing is done with it. It's simply there for humans to look at to get a better understanding of what's around it. You don't have to worry about what you put between those except to make it useful, helpful to yourself or to others reading your code, which is also very important. So you want to be very clear, especially when you have a TF grading it. Also here you see two slashes. That's similar. It also creates a comment, but as you'll notice, if I hit enter and start typing things here, it does not extend between lines. You just put the /* at the beginning. It extends to the end of the line and no further, so if you type anything below that, you're responsible for it, and the compiler is going to look at it. So in this comment, I've written header files are included here. So what does that mean exactly? Well, We see here I've written a sharp include stdio.h and a sharp include cs50.h. Now what these are header files, and they contain libraries. And all you need to know about libraries is essentially that they contain other code, which you, if you include them at the beginning of your program, are going to be able to use in the code that you write. So I've included here stdio.h. Anyone have any idea what that stands for? Maybe a little
intuition.
Yeah, exactly. Standard input output. That includes functions like printf, scanf, and a few other very standard simple functions that are often used in C programs. The one you want to be most concerned with right now, and the one we'll look at a little bit more in depth, is printf. It's probably the most important one to you at the moment. You see I've also included sharp include cs50.h. That's one of our course standard header files, which includes some functions that if you've looked into the first problem set or watched the lecture videos, you might have noticed were used occasionally in some examples. They just make it a little simpler to get basically values to place in data types, and we're using them just kind of as training wheels right now. All right, so following where we include our library files, we have the main function. And the function that you can include the bulk of your code in, or rather, the code that is executed immediately, not necessarily where you place the bulk of your lines, and you'll see that in the future, is executed from main. As soon as the program runs, main runs. So think of it just as the basic function. This defines what happens in your program, essentially. So main is normally written in this format. You have int main. And then you contain these parameters, int argc, char star argv. You may have learned from lecture that char star means a string. We haven't really covered exactly what the square brackets mean right now. You don't really need to know that at the moment. All you need to know is that when you're beginning your program and you have your main function, you want to write it in this format just to create the basic skeleton of what you're going to be writing. And then code, which is placed between the curly brackets, is executed. Does anyone have any questions as to like the basic framework of the C file that you're going to be generally creating? Is that more or less clear, or is there something that's a little... Okay. So good. All right. It's asking me to save. Okay. All right. So going back into program.c for just a moment... Suppose we were to just put some simple line of code here, nothing that's really going to do much of interest, but just as a demonstration, kind of the epitomal first program, hello world. So now we have a text file called program.c. It contains a bunch of instructions that conform to the C programming language, and that's about it. So how exactly do we get that to a format in which the computer is doing what we've told it to do? Exactly. C is a compiled language, and what that essentially means is that we use a compiler, in this case a program called GCC, which is a Unix C compiler, which is going to take the code we've written, figure out what exactly it is we're saying for the computer to do, and then convert it to something that's called a binary file or an executable. An output file, which the computer can then run, and it will execute the instructions which we've provided it in C. So let's go ahead and do that. So the way we do that is by going back to our shell command line, typing GCC, the name of the compiler which we're using, then -o, is telling it, providing this parameter, letting it know we want it to output something, we want to create this output file. The name of the file we want to create, in this case, I'm just going to call it program. I wouldn't have to call it program. I could call it something arbitrary. Then the name of the source code file, program.c. And then there's one more parameter which I'm going to have to provide for this particular file, or that I at least should. Does anyone have an idea what that might be? Exactly. So we've included a header file called cs50.h. And what that means is that we're trying to take advantage of some functions which are included in the CS50 library. So what that essentially means to you at the compiler level is that when you're typing in this command and you want to create an executable from the source code you've typed up, you need to add one more command, -l for link, CS50, the name of the header file, and then That's all you need. You press enter. Unless you receive any complaints and have to go back to your source code to fix something that was wrong, you now should have an executable file called whatever you called it, in this case program. And if we run that, we get hello world. Okay. So does anyone have any questions about using the GCC? Yes, sir.
You know, with the program.c, it's just a text file. Does it have to be called .c or .txt?
Let's take a look. It actually makes no difference. If we were to write it out as program.qrt, for example, not the best idea, just because it defies convention and is unintuitive, but if I were to run GCC on that, it shouldn't make any difference. I believe it was qr.qrt. Oh, I stand corrected, actually. GCC is apparently checking for the file format. It sees QRT as something that's foreign and doesn't want to do that. Let's try renaming it to just program 2 without an extension and see if that makes a difference. Okay, so best bet is to place .c at the end, because it seems that GCC does take issue with some endings on the files and provides an error message warning that that's not necessarily what we want to be doing. So yeah, you'd want to definitely adhere to that convention strictly when using GCC in order to avoid any unfortunate errors. Thank you for pointing that out, because that is some behavior which I didn't necessarily expect we would see. Okay. So does anyone have any other questions about the GCC compiler, how to create an executable source code? Yes, ma'am.
So that dash LCS50?
Yes.
Is because you add a header file called CS50?
Yes.
Okay. But you don't have to do it for the STDIO?
It's not necessary to provide an extra argument to GCC to include STD.io.h. It's just such a common header file. It's something that's not necessary. Almost any program that you ever write in C is going to have sharp include stdio.h. It's difficult to do a whole lot without it if you're involving any type of user input. Any other questions? Okay, so let's move on. Now, what should we do first? Let's take a look at kelvin.c. So we're going to talk a little bit about how we can solve some simple problems using the C programming language. So the first example that I'd like to put before you and work through with the room is Kelvin.c. Now this is a program which should convert a temperature which is given to it in the form of an integer from Fahrenheit to Kelvin. And then it also mentions kind of cryptically that it comments on the nature of a result. We'll worry about that later. So where would we start in writing this function? What's the first thing which we should be including, so to speak? Exactly. So we need to include our header files in what we call the preprocessor operations. So sharp include, we probably want to include stdio.h. Seems like something we'll need. We might also want CS50's header file, so let's just put that in there for now in case. All right, so that's taken care of. What else? What comes next? All right, so we've got our header files there. Our sharp includes are out of the way. Might as well go ahead and get started on the bulk of the function. So we'll just type in our main function. And does everyone know why it's int main? Okay. Sorry?
Why
it's int main? Why that int there, that int? Okay, so functions, when a function is declared like main, it's preceded by the type of what it will return. We mentioned in it was mentioned by the professor in the previous lecture that some functions can also be of type void, which means they don't return anything. The reason main is of type int is because a main function by convention generally is going to return a zero or some other number, and by using this number you can determine what sort of error might have occurred at a certain point in the program. If the program anticipates an error could happen in the program, could exit unexpectedly, they might have it return a different number. That's not something that you have to worry about right now, so don't become overly concerned by it. But it's just a little insight into the convention and the framework that we're putting together here. So then we have the parameters which we need to always provide to int main, which are okay.
Int
argc. Int argc. Okay, good. And then we just have our curly braces here to contain whatever code we end up writing. So we want to convert a temperature in Fahrenheit to a temperature in Kelvin. So in terms of the program going through its thing and getting everything done we want it to, what's the first thing that we need to do? Yeah. So we're going to have to get that Fahrenheit temperature from the user before we can really do anything with it. So how exactly should we go about that? What's the first step in getting input from the user and preparing to store it?
Create a variable in which to store it.
Good. So create a variable. What should we store it? Is an int good, or should we store it in something else?
If we're going to store it as an int, that means that it can't give us a temperature that isn't an integer.
Right.
So maybe we want them to be able to do that.
Okay. So if we were to use the integer data type, what that would essentially mean is that we're limiting anything that can come in or be stored to strict integers. So numbers like 1, 3, negative 2, anything that's like a whole strict number, we're not allowing for decimals, we're not considering decimals. That might be unnecessarily limiting ourselves. So we could use another data type in C. Can anyone think of an example that we could use in this situation? Yeah. Float, a floating point decimal data type. So we have a float. We'll name it something intuitive. We could just call it fair, stand for a Fahrenheit temperature. It's kind of easy to see what's stored there. It's not cryptic at all. It's a good variable name. So afterwards, we have this variable. It holds a float. We haven't done anything yet. So what can we do to make that useful now? Okay, so we can use one of CS50.h's built-in functions to get a float from the user at this point. So the way we would do that is we'd write an assignment operation. So we take our variable and we set it equal to, which is a single equal sign, so that's our assignment operator. If I were to use two equal signs, that wouldn't quite work out. Does anyone know why?
That's for comparing two things to see if they're equivalent.
Absolutely. That's how we connect, how we express kind of a conditional in a Boolean expression. If we were to use equal, what the compiler would do is check if the two values there are equal and then do something as a result if we were to format it correctly. So what we want to use is the assignment operator. So we just use one equal sign to make Fahrenheit equal to something else. And then we execute a built-in function in CS50.h called getFloat. And what that's going to do is prompt the user at that point for a value and wait for a floating point value to be typed in and then entered. And then that floating point variable will be stored in Fahrenheit and we'll have our Fahrenheit variable to do with what we please. Okay, so let's just comment this. Try to stay in good form just to... you don't have to comment every line saying what this does. It gets a little tedious. It's not necessary because most people who are going to be looking at your code can tell what a single line is doing. But if you kind of comment chunks of your code, it saves people the trouble of trying to figure out what all your variables are for and exactly what you're doing on a line-by-line basis. So we can sum up these two lines saying we get Fahrenheit temperature from user. Okay. So now we have this Fahrenheit temperature. I don't know if... Yes?
Prompting the user to put in the...
Sorry?
Like, do we need to use a printf function to actually ask the user for that?
Yeah, that's very good. And I almost overlooked that. But at this point, what you'd just get is you'd run your program, and then it would instantly just wait for a response, which isn't very helpful because your user might not know what it's doing if the program's just hanging or sitting there. So you want to use a printf function, and then provide one single argument in the form of a string between these quotation marks, and you would put something like just Fahrenheit temp, and then maybe a colon and a space, so that when the user is prompted to type something in, it'll appear right here above the after that space. If you were to put a new line character there, what it would do is print that line and then move down to the next and then prompt the user, which is normally not what you want just because it doesn't look as nice. Not an essential thing to worry about right now, and as you're working, you'll be able to style that accordingly. It'll be obvious what that's doing. But
does it matter which order, whether the printf comes before or after the definition of the FAHR?
It actually has no bearing whatsoever. If I were to switch the order, Control-K, go back up here, Control-U, what happens here is the computer is printing something on the screen, initializing this variable, and then asking me to provide a float value. So absolutely, yeah, it makes no difference whatsoever. As long as we're not trying to use that variable before it's been stored somewhere in memory by declaring the variable, we're absolutely fine. Printf doesn't really make a difference. Okay, good question. So at this point, we've got our variable stored in memory somewhere. We know the Fahrenheit temperature that we're going to be doing something with, but we haven't really done anything with it yet. So I don't know about you guys, but I don't know off the top of my head, at least without thinking about it for a second, how to convert Fahrenheit to Kelvin. So you can just check online. We've got a function right here. Essentially, Kelvin is converted Fahrenheit is converted to Celsius by subtracting 32. Multiplying it by 5/9, and then Celsius can be converted to Kelvin by adding 273. Okay, so we have a couple operations going on there. We have to subtract 32, multiply all of that by 5/9, which is equivalent to dividing by 1/8, or 1.8 rather, sorry, and then we add 273 to that. So, much as we learned in a high school algebra classes, in terms of order of operations, many of the same rules apply. There's a few more confusing rules of precedence, which you can look up if you ever get into a situation where you're not sure what's going to happen before what in an arithmetic operation in C. But in this situation, it's not all that complicated. So what are we trying to do essentially right now? We're trying to take what we have already and then store a new value somewhere else, which provides us with our Kelvin temperature. So what would be the first thing we want to think about doing?
Make a variable for the Kelvin temperature?
Absolutely. And what type should that be? Just like, yeah. Since we're starting off with a float value, it would seem kind of silly to convert that into an integer and then maybe get rid of some of the precision that the float gives us. So we create our new float. And we might as well call it Kelvin. That seems like the best thing to call it. And as we're initializing it, previously when we initialized float Fahrenheit, we initialized it, and then in a separate line, we assigned it to something. You can actually just do it all in one line. If I type in float Kelvin, and then an equal sign for an assignment operator, and then go on to type something else to provide a value to be stored in that variable, that's acceptable. You don't have to do two lines at all. As long as you provide the data type at the beginning, it knows that it's declaring a variable, and you're safe doing that. So we take float Kelvin, and the function, I believe, was Fahrenheit temperature minus 32, multiply that by 5/9, and then add 273. So we can actually just fairly simply sub that variable name in for the symbol we were using in the algebra previously, subtract 32. We use parentheses just like we might in math class. Multiply by 5/9, and then because we have order of operations here, we add 273 at the end. And what this should do, unless I've made some sort of mistake, is take our Fahrenheit temperature, do some math with it, and then store the Kelvin conversion in our Kelvin variable. And I do see one mistake that I've made. Does anyone have an idea? It's not a straight-up math mistake. It's a computer science mistake. It's a coding mistake. So what is it here that just isn't quite right?
So, you've got all the numbers in your equation are integers.
Okay, why does that cause a problem? Where does it cause a problem specifically?
In the division.
The division. Okay, so if we take the integer 5 and divide it by the integer 9, using C, just feeding the compiler that and letting it do with it what it will, and having the processor executing that integer division, what's our result going to be? 5 divided by 9 integers.
0.
Yeah. We're just going to get a zero there because 5 divided by 9 integer division doesn't take into account rounding. It does not take into account any sort of remainder. It just says, how many times is 9 going to 5? You can't fit 9 into 5. It's 0. So what we need to do is make these be represented as floats. And we might have talked about typecasting. I mean, one way you could do this is by typing float in front of each of these, and then the computer would know, okay, I have to look at these variable, these constants as floats rather than integers, what they look like. That's a little messy. There's really no reason to clutter up your code with something like that. It's a lot easier just to be explicit and show that when you say 9, you mean the float value 9. Simple way to do that, make it 9.0, make it 5.0. You actually only would need to do it with 1, because if you're dealing with one float variable, you need to do float division. But if we can just be a little extra explicit by placing these, and it's no slower. So might as well do that. Okay. Does anyone else see any more problems with this, or does it look like it's pretty much good? Yeah, that's the next step. All right. So right now, this program has essentially taken in this Fahrenheit value. It's converted it into Kelvin. And now that's stored in memory, but it's no use to us because we haven't done anything with it yet. If we ran this program right now, it's calculated something, and it doesn't tell us what it found out. So what we can do is using the printf statement, which you'll be finding yourself using very often, and just type in Kelvin conversion, for example. And then we need some way to place the value of the calculation we've made, which is now stored in Kelvin, into the string we're printing out. So any ideas how we might kind of join that in there to add it to the string? Sorry?
A plus.
A plus?
Close quotation and plus.
And add a plus? And then you would type in the variable name, for example? That's how it works in a lot of different programming languages, so that's a good thing to bring up. That's not actually how string concatenation works in C, or, at least in printf, and it's done a little bit differently. Okay. %f is actually the way that it's generally formatted in printf. So percent means you're going to have like a letter. I'm sorry, did you say something else?
Oh, I was just giving the rest.
Oh, sure.
Okay, comma, float.
Yeah. Okay, right, so %f would represent the float data type, which we're going to be placing there after the string has been formatted and printed to the screen. So we just end the string, place a comma here to indicate that we're going to be providing another parameter to printf now, type in the name of the float value, which we want to be subbed in, and if we were, for example, for some reason including the Fahrenheit temperature as well, like we wanted to say the original Fahrenheit temperature is something, we would put another %f there, and we would include another additional parameter, which we'd just write there. But we're not going to place that there right now, so that was just something to think about in the event that you wanted to place more than one value into your string, which we might deal with later. So right now we've got these two parameters, this string, and then this value which can be placed in the string using printf. Okay, so does this look like it's about done? Seems to have all the components that we want to include.
How about a new line?
Very perceptive. I was going to wait and see if we would get to compiling before someone noticed that. But yeah, so what would happen if we hadn't included that new line? What would have happened is that... Yeah, exactly. It would run the program, it would print out that, and then instead of going to the next line and giving you a prompt to do something else in your shell script, or your shell prompt, rather, sorry, you would get that followed immediately by your username and a prompt to type something in. And it looks a little awkward. It's not the best way to output your data because it makes it very confusing to read. And it's best to just end with that new line so that you get a clean new line to place your prompt on, and it's much easier for your user to read, and it should be easy for to read. You're writing an entire program just to provide this information. Okay, so Control-O, write it out. Name it Kelvin.c, that's fine. Control-X to leave. And now, and remember what I'd type in to generate a program from this source code? All right, so GCC, it is kind of a long list of parameters just to have on the top of your head. you'll all know it by the end of the semester, believe me. GCC-O for output, the name of the program, the executable program you want to create, Kelvin in this case, then followed by the name of the source code file. And then finally, since we used git float and we included cs50.h at the top of the file, lcs50 to link in that cs50 library so that we include those functions and are able to use them in our final executable file. Hit enter. Hopefully all goes well. Seems to have. So let's go ahead and test our program. We've got Kelvin. We have it wants a Fahrenheit temperature example.
68,
sure. 293. So seems about right to me. All right, great. So we just got through our first C program. Does anyone have any questions on like the process, how we arrived at what we did, anything that seemed confusing that didn't quite add up while we were running through that?
I've got a question. If we changed the type of variable of Kelvin to int instead of float, would the result that's returned be 293?
In this case, it should be, unless there's something else that causes an issue.
And what if the temperature in Fahrenheit that we entered gave a value of 293.8? Then you would it round up or not?
Let's go ahead and just type in another random number and see if we can get one of those cases, because it's very odd that we just got randomly. Okay, so what was your question again specifically?
So my question is, if we go back in and change the variable Kelvin from float to int, what will happen to our answer?
It should.
My guess is it will be 298.
Yeah, it should round right off.
Let's. But will it round or will it truncate?
Truncation.
Okay.
It should be 298. Let's go ahead and change that and just see what happens so we can observe it. Oh, another handy thing just to realize: if you're at the prompt and you just typed in a lengthy command, usually something to compile your file, went back and made a change, and don't want to have to type the whole thing out again, you just press your up and down arrow keys. It'll cycle through all your recent commands, find the one you want, hit enter, and it does it again. Kelvin. Okay, so we had typed in 78 previously, probably get 298. 298. It truncates off the decimals, and we end up with an integer value. And I'm glad you brought that up, actually. That reminds me of something else. So well, we got that value. We went out to about the 10,000th place, something like that. That's not the most useful thing to look at most of the time. So we see here where, let me change this back to float just so it's a little more close to what we intended it to be. Is anyone here familiar with the width and precision modifiers which we can use for, okay. So when we're using printf and we include this percent sign and then this letter representing the data type which we want to include in the string, we also have an option of including two separate types of numbers between those two symbols, which can alter the way that the computer is going to show that data on the screen. So those are our width and our precision values. So if I were to type something like 3 without a decimal place, that should include just the idea that it should have a width of 3. So if our answer were something like 98, what that essentially means is that we're going to, on the screen, we're going to have just this space reserved, 1 space, 2 space, 3 space, and it's going to print 98 here. So if for some reason I wanted to print like a list of values, and I knew that it was going to start at 1 and then go up past 100, then I don't want all my values to look like, 9, 10 like this. I want them to look like 9, 10, 99, 100. It's just mainly for formatting so that your output looks a little nicer, it's more presentable, and it's very useful. And another thing we can do is place a decimal point there to indicate we want to provide something else after that, the precision value. And what this does in terms of a float is mean, if I were to say we wanted to print a float with a precision value of 2, what would you intuitively think that means? Yeah. So rather than going out to, I don't remember what it was, 298.3567892, it'd go to 298 and then print the next two decimal points. Pardon me. That's interesting. Okay, I'll just keep talking while I give this power so that I can get this back online for us. So essentially when we're dealing with those width and position values. The width value is something which is defining how many spaces we want to reserve on the screen for that value, and then print what we do have on the rightmost side. And then the precision is just how many decimal points we want to go out to with the full answer. So, for example, when we have those long decimals, we might only use a couple values, only want to display those just because those are the only ones that are useful. Bear with me just for a moment while I get this being responsive once again. I apologize for that. And we are back. All right. And as I said, you provide the width value first, followed by a decimal point, and then however far you might want to go. So say we want a width of 5 and a precision of 2, which provides the two numbers after the decimal point. Let's just try that and see how that changes exactly what type of input we're getting. Pardon me?
It didn't save.
It didn't save? Oh, it said overflow buffer, and then what was it? I think it did. 27. Oh, yeah, that. 28. Oh, we didn't get the precision. Interesting.
You were saying that the variable before when it crashed.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, because we lost the internet connection, and I didn't notice that. Had not saved, that we just changed it to an integer. Thank you, guys. Okay. So now we should get the behavior that we're expecting. All right, so running the program again, 65, for example. All right, so now we're getting 291.33. It's going out to 2 degrees of precision and maintaining that width of 5 that we were looking for. All right, good. Okay. Does anyone have any more questions about string formatting and using printf?
So if you didn't want to have more than one variable printed out, you would go left to right. So, the first float, the second float, and then Kelvin, then printf.
Absolutely. You would place comma-separated parameters after your formatted string in the order in which they're intended to be injected into your string. So if I had that float value there, and then later in the string I had a decimal number, or an integer rather, I'd put a percent %d after the percent %f, and then I'd put that integer after Kelvin. And I would just sub them in the order in which they're provided. So blow off. Okay. How much time do we have left? We have a little bit. Okay, so let's just look at one more problem, which is it's one that's often brought up in early parts of computer science courses, just to kind of describe functions, but we'll use it to describe just kind of how to think programmatically and use types of loops. So suppose we wanted to write a function that returned to the factorial of an integer which we gave it. Is everyone familiar with what a factorial is? Okay, just to review, you probably all know, but so if you were to take the factorial of a number 5, for example, it's usually represented as a 5 exclamation point, or 5 bang, if we were talking computer science terms. It basically means you're taking 5, you're multiplying it by 4, multiplying it by 3, multiplying by 2, multiplied 1, and for 5 factorial, you'd get 120, and that's your answer. 6 factorial would be 720, and it'd go up from there. So we can easily write a function, much in the same way that I'll just include the header information since we are running low on time, and get to the meat of the problem. So we type in again our main function, provide the parameters int argc, char star, argv, get to our curly braces. Okay. So So much like the other function, the first thing we need to do is get input from the user so we know exactly what frame the factorial of. So what's a good data type to store this particular value in? Yeah, an integer will be sufficient because we're not really able to find the factorial of floating point value. It doesn't really make sense in that context. It makes a lot more sense just to use the integer and not to worry about the decimals and store the value in here. So we have int n, and since we're including cs50.h, we can just use the function getInt, which is built into cs50. You can use it as long as you link in that library to your file. Get the value. And then... So what then? It's not immediately obvious because you can't just type in times make some variable equal to n times n minus 1 times n minus 2, because that you'd have to stop at some point and you need to know, in the mind of the program exactly when to stop. So it's not something you can just hard code specifically in that straightforward way. So this seems like a situation in which we should use a loop which can check some kind of condition to know when it stops. Does anyone have an idea of like a type of loop which might be useful here? You could use a while loop. A for loop might be more appropriate in this situation, just because it's something that is a little more... We'll see why it applies a little better. But also it's just a good idea to introduce the idea of for loops because... In my opinion, it's just the most versatile and most useful type of loop that we'll be using in the course, and something that's definitely worthwhile to know about. Okay, so in a for loop, you include in parentheses after the word for three different parameters, all separated by these two semicolons. So the first thing you can do before the first semicolon is to initialize any variables you're going to want to be using. So what do we want to keep track of while we're doing this? We want to keep track of like our products, right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what's a good way we could keep track of like what we've done already, and what's a good way to keep track of how much left we have to do, so to speak? Maybe that's not the best way to put it. Perhaps we could have some way of counting down to determine when we get to a point where we can stop working, and we also could have something to keep track of the work we've already done. So it seems like where we have n, say we plug 5 into that, if we were to take 5 times 4 factorial, that gives us 5 factorial. If we have 4 factorial times 3 factorial, that gives us 4 factorial. So what we could do is then use that value there and use it kind of as a counter and count down, and keep multiplying some other variable by the value we just had, so that we're keeping track of the work we're doing and moving forward in the problem, and also keeping track of how low we're getting. This is kind of more of a complex problem, but I think it's a very good way of kind of explaining the versatility of the for loop. So let's just take a look at some of the things we can plug in here. So the first thing we can do in the for loop is kind of declaring just any variables which we want to use to kind of keep track of something while we're going through the loop. So suppose we were to make one called factn. Okay, so that what should we initialize factn to? What's it makes since we're going to be multiplying numbers against it? What's a good starting point? Okay.
Zero.
We could start with 0, but then if we were to multiply it by some value, it wouldn't change. So normally when we're using for loops, we'll typically start with 0 just because it's the natural starting point when you're incrementing, and it's easy to keep track of how many things you've done as when you start at 0. In this case, since we're going to be multiplying, we'll just use a 1. So this is just an example of how a for loop doesn't always have to initialize a variable that's a counter that goes through a certain number of times and then exits. It can be used to declare a variable which kind of keeps track of what we're doing. And you could have also declared this separately and then just left this blank. You don't actually have to have anything before the semicolon, but it's necessary to have the semicolon there. So we'll put it there for now. We'll set it equal to 1. Okay, so when do we want this? The second thing we provide is a condition to check, which if it's true, the loop executes again. So when do we want this to, since we're going to be changing n, and what are we going to be doing to this is probably better to talk about first. What are we going to be doing to n at the end of each loop, just to make sure we're on the same page algorithmically? Yeah. So we're going to decrement it. What that essentially means is that after this has been, each time this loop has been run, we're going to make n go down by 1. And to what end are we going to do that? Why are we decrementing n? We must have a reason for that. So we want this function to keep on multiplying by whatever the current value of n is until what? When's the natural stopping point? Okay, interesting thought, but that wouldn't necessarily be true at the condition we want to reach, because fact n, say we start with 5, we multiply that by 5, fact n is now 5, n is decremented, it's now 4, and at that point we'd actually be done, and then we'd end at a point we're not actually looking for. So if we're taking, let's think about the values we're going to be working with. If fact n is 1 right now, n is 5, we... Sorry?
When n equals 1.
Close. That's the condition. That's when we want to stop. So this condition which we provide is when we want to keep going. So we kind of want something opposite. Yes, exactly. That's what we're looking for. So when n is greater than 1, then we want to execute this loop. Just form that square. So what we've got now is the structure of our loop, and a variable we're initializing, a way of counting down each time we've done something, and the condition which must be satisfied each time the for loop is run through. Does anyone have any questions about that particular aspect of the for loop? Because that's just an important detail to have at your disposal. Sure. You'll see this first thing in the for loop, int fact n equals 1. That's where you declare a variable that you might want to use in the context of the for loop. Then there's a semicolon. Then there's this conditional. This is checked every time the for loop is run. If that is satisfied, it continues and it runs the for loop again that time. If it's not, it quits the entire thing. At the end, you see n minus minus. That means that after the loop is run, every time, it's going to do that. So every time we've executed this code, which we're going to include under in these curly braces, n goes down by 1. Okay. Is that clear to everybody? It's just a really useful tool that I want you to be able to make the full use of.
Do you set fact n equal to, does it matter which you set fact n equal to?
In this case, since we're, because the algorithm...
It's going to change every time it runs, right? Isn't that just the initial value?
The initial value of fact n. That's a good thing to point out. That's what it's initially set to.
Right.
When this loops through again, it's not going to reset it to 1. That only happens one time.
Right, it's going to store its new value.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter what you set it to now. Could I set n equal, fact n equals 5?
It will matter depending on how you implement it. If you would set it equal to... The reason I chose 1 is because since we're multiplying things against it,
yeah.
it's going to be a... It's kind of a scalar that acts against it. So if we start with 5, if we run this, it's going to end up being 5 times more just because we're always multiplying against it.
Right.
If we start with 1, it's the identity operator... Yeah, number for multiplication, so... In this, but you're right that you could initialize it to anything you wanted in other cases.
Okay.
It would just change the way your results were returned. Okay. And so does anyone have any ideas for how to implement it's just a single line. We're using fact n to keep track of what we've done. Fact n equals... And keep in mind, you can use the previous value of fact n as part of the assignment operation.
Fact n.
Fact n. And what are we doing to it?
Times n.
Yes. So what this essentially means is we're taking fact n on the left side, and we're assigning that to be the previous value of fact n, and then multiplying it by the current value of n. So what this essentially means, walking through it, is we start out with fact n at 1. Oh, let's say our initial n is 3. So we've got 3. Fact n is set to what fact n is now, 1 times 3. Now we go to loop again. N has been decremented. It's now 2, which is greater than 1, so we do this again. Fact n is 3. 3 times 2, 6. Then n becomes 1. N is no longer greater than 1, so this leaves. And... just to quickly finish this up so we can give up the room, you just write a printf statement, factorial of the number is %d, plug in factn, which is our integer variable. We use %d because it's an integer, and that should return to the user the output. And just check that it works correctly. So we'd have factorial.c, link in the CS50 library. Each function appears in factn is undeclared. Oh, good thing to bring up. Factn is undeclared. Just to solve this quickly so we can get out of here and let them have their own. This should do it. We forgot to printf something to prompt for the variable. We type in 3, and we return the factorial. The number is 6. Okay. So does anyone have any questions on what happened there, how the for loop worked, or how to implement that?
What was the problem with the initialization?
We didn't have.
You compare the variable in the for loop.
Yeah. It seemed. Normally in a for loop, the variable you're initializing there is used within the context of the for loop, and it's not so much used externally. So by trying to print it later, we were running into an issue. And yeah, it was just something we should have had a little more time to work through, which I was going to talk about. But since we were just running on a little low on time, I kind of let it go and corrected it so we could see the way the program was working. So does anyone have any other questions about implementing solutions to problems in C or working through how to create a for loop and make it do what you want to do? Okay. All right. Great. Thank you guys very much. Have a great week and good luck with the first problem set.